Do-do-do-do-do-do. It's Weird Stuff Happens in Canada, and it's Britt doing the introductory part. Yes, it is. Emily's regretting everything.
Is that like a theme song you wrote for us?
Yeah, I just wrote it. I wrote it and I spent a lot of time on it.
Was the beginning just the beginning of the Hockey Night in Canada?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Cool.
It was pretty derivative.
I mean, it's very on brand, so...
That's true.
That's fine.
This is Weird Stuff Happens in Canada. I'm Britt.
And I'm Emily.
And this is weird every time.
We'll get better at it.
Anyways.
Hey, Britt, you know what I'd like?
What?
A drink.
I know. So, Emers and I have decided to do an episode on bootlegging. And this was Emily's idea, I think probably because she's having dry January.
Guys, it's so boring.
Yeah, I opted not to do dry January, which is why I'm having my second glass of wine.
Yeah, I was like, Britt, a bunch of us have decided to do dry January. Would you like to join? And she was like, nope, and walked away.
Yeah, I flipped the table over, and then I took all the alcohol out, and I dumped it over myself, and I said, woo, wet January.
Don't call it that.
Anyways, long story short, we're talking about bootlegging today.
Bootlegging in Canada. It's a work in progress.
Would you like to go first?
No.
I think I should go first.
I think you should go first, because I think you have more sort of general information about prohibition and legging of the boots.
Very well researched.
Mm-hmm. Thorough, I would
Thoroughly
say.
Thoroughly researched. All right.
We'll share our bibliographies later.
So, I'm talking about prohibition in Prince Edward Island.
Hooray!
Why Prince Edward Island, you might ask?
I might.
Because it was the first and the last province to implement prohibition as law.
So they, like, loved prohibition.
Yeah. They had the longest era by far of anywhere in Canada. From 1901 to 1948.
Oh, my God! And
to kind of put it in perspective, most provinces started around 1916 at the earliest.
Sure.
And the latest it lasted in any province was in Nova Scotia in 1930. So PEI was like, nope, we're going way beyond
that. So
there
was 18 additional years. There was the lifespan of a full-grown adult human in between when everyone else in Canada was drinking and when PEI started drinking again.
Yep, you got it.
Cool.
So we're going to talk a little bit about that. But before we start, let's talk a little bit about why did it even happen?
Well, probably a lot of people were getting drunk.
You got it.
I know.
So, there was a little thing called the temperance movement.
Oh, that was like ladies who were like, we hate booze because it turns men into gross pigs.
Pretty much. They wanted to close the drinking establishments, which they viewed...
Maybe they wore sashes.
...as a source of social ills.
Yeah.
So they were like, these establishments, they're making everyone crazy.
Crazy.
So the main organizations at the time were the poorly named Dominion Alliance for the Total Suppression of Liquor Traffic.
Yeah, the DASTLT. Classic DASTLT.
There was also the Women's Christian Temperance Union of Canada.
That's a bit better.
Yeah. And then, at the same time, Baptists, Methodists, Presbyterians, and Congregationalists also believed in temperance just as part of their religious beliefs. So
sure.
They were, like, very in support of the temperance movement.
Yep.
So they used politics, educational reform to kind of push the idea of temperance. They were really all about indoctrinating the youth. So,
gotta
you
get
know,
them young.
They put it into schools. They put it into Sunday school. But because this was done, like, education was done on, like, a province-by-province basis, you don't really have a lot of, like, countrywide control, which
sure.
is why by prohibition kind of came in province-by-province at different times. So, before PEI, there was prohibition in the Northwest Territories starting in 1874. And this was because of the Cypress Hills Massacre. Do you know about that?
Yeah, I do, but you should probably explain it just for everybody else.
Okay, cool. I'll tell everyone else about the Cypress Hills Massacre.
Yeah.
So, essentially,
I'll check your work.
Long story short, there was this crazy, really ridiculous fight that broke out between fur traders and a group of Aboriginal people, and there was these wolfers who were like, they were like, somebody stole our horses. Somebody did steal their horses. And they were like, oh, I bet it was those Aboriginal people. And then they went over and there was like whiskey traders there. And the whiskey traders were hella drunk. And they were like, oh, it was those guys. I know it was. And then he like went over and started like riling everything up. And the Aboriginal people were like, it was not us. Like, what are you talking about? We had nothing to do with that. We're like literally a group of like men, women, and children just here. Living our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And the whiskey traders were like, nope, they did it. It like exploded into violence. It ended with, the numbers are vary depending on who you ask, but anywhere from 13 to 20 of the Aboriginal people died.
God.
And one of the traders died as well. And so everyone was like, these whiskey traders are like no good
They're
for anyone.
Good. And also
stirred the pot.
Who stole the horses?
Nobody else.
Oh my God.
Somebody else did. So that led to people seeing the need for reform. They felt as though the whiskey trading business that was happening up in the territories was really detrimental to the Aboriginal people that lived there.
They're not wrong.
No, they are not wrong. And it also led to the direct implementation of the Northwest Mounted Police, which would eventually become...
The Mounties!
Exactly, because the real problem was that the fur traders, when their horses were stolen, they went to, like, some soldiers, and they were like, help us, our horses. And they were like, well, not our jurisdiction. And
right.
So they were like, we need someone to, like, control all this shit. And then when Prohibition became a thing across the country, they were like, oh, we can use the Northwest Mounted Police to, like, enforce this also.
Because if someone on a horse tells you you can't drink, you have to listen to them.
Exactly. Excuse me. So, to kind of finish that off, some communities in the Northwest Territory still remain dry to this day.
What?
So it did kind of work. But officially, Prohibition ended in the Northwest Territories in 1891. However, on the horizon, a little province called PEI was like, that seems like a good idea. And at the same time, they were drafting an act called the Temperance Act. So in 1892, legislation was passed. It was an act to, quote, regulate by police and municipal regulations the sale of intoxicating liquors in the city of Charlottetown and to preserve therein public decency and repress drunkenness and disorderly conduct. And that act came into effect on June 5th, 1901. And then, boom, Charlottetown, dry. Nobody's drinking anymore. Or were they? I bet you can guess.
I bet they were.
There was a very famous ship called the Nellie J. Banks.
Ah, Nellie J.
Nellie J. And if you go to Charlottetown today, you will see a memorial to the Nellie J. Banks and the men who sailed it, the Dix brothers. Maybe relation to your family? Who knows?
Ours doesn't have an S.
Oh, shit. So the Dix brothers smuggled thousands of kegs from the French islands of Saint-Pierre and carried about $100,000 worth of liquor per trip to Prince Edward Island.
Whoa!
So how they would get it in there was they would weigh this, they would like put bottles in sacks, put a bunch of salt in the sacks, and then they would throw the sacks overboard. And so then the salt would eventually disintegrate, and then the bottles would like bob to the surface. And then there was the rum runners had these dogs that were trained to save men from drowning. So they'd like swim out and grab them. So they would like swim out and get the bottles and like bring them back.
Oh my God.
That's how it was done in PEI. Rum running, PEI style. So the Nellie J. Banks was official. It was the most famous and also the last rum runner in Atlantic Canada. It was finally caught on August 9th, 1938, 10 years before PEI repealed Prohibition. Do you think that stopped them?
No!
You're right. They kept drinking. Sorry. Jesus.
Britt's having some milk issues.
So, what happened in the 1930s? Was Prohibition successful? As one by one, Canadian provinces and American states began to repeal Prohibition, everyone looked with interest towards PEI. It became a kind of, like, case study of, does Prohibition work? Mm-hmm. And everyone's, like, sitting back drinking their cocktails, and they're like, look at these guys. And PEI became known as one of the last outposts of Prohibition. And the islanders, they kept putting it up for a vote, like, should we repeal Prohibition? The islanders kept voting it down. They're like, no, we want to remain dry. And they were like, people in the temperance movement were like, oh, look, this is what the people want. But really, the people were selling shit out of their, like, bootleg storefronts and making a ton more money than they ever would have if it became legally controlled by the government. So they just kept voting it down. Excuse me. So a census conducted in 1892 found that 75 liquor outlets were selling alcohol in the city of Charlottetown. So there were 75 different outlets in Charlottetown selling booze illegally.
There was probably only 75 people in Charlottetown at the time.
And so, like, if you were caught, there is, like, a pretty high fine or you'd get prison time, which could be, like, hugely detrimental if you have, like, a wife and kids. But people were like, meh, it's worth the risk because I'm making so much money from it. So delegations from the Women's Temperance Movement, they were, like, mailing the island premiers tirelessly, like, over and over saying, like, keep this in control. We want Prohibition. there was also a Prohibition Commission.
Prohibition Commission.
Yeah, exactly. Which was run by three Catholic priests and three Protestant ministers.
Is this, like, the beginning of a joke?
No. And under the commission, islanders, the only way they were able to get alcohol was through prescriptions given out to them by their doctor, because at the time they thought that booze was...
Because I need it for medicine.
Exactly. But there was a letter from Premier Bell to Samuel Martin of the commission that said, quote, only 5 to 10% of liquor got under prescription was for the use of medicine. So, like, 95% was being used for just drinking. And then there was another letter to Premier Arsenal, who was Premier of PEI from 1917 to 1919. And it was, like, from this random constituent. And he was like, by the way, I wish you could take a bit of the edge off that prohibition law, as a little would be very nice every cold morning when a fellow thinks he has the flu.
Lol.
So a lot of people, I found this really great article that was just, like, all these letters people were writing to the premiers, like, over the years. Mm-hmm. So as a little taste of, like, what's going on during Prohibition. So to Premier Stewart, who was premier 1923 to 1927, we had a young man arrested for having a still. He was later taken before the judge and convicted. He could not pay his fine, so he was put into the Georgetown jail. The next morning, he was out and home. The jailer informed me that he, quote, crawled through the bars. The young man was never arrested again. He is at home in Greektown and is a menace to the place. Mr. Stewart, would you please have this man sent back to where he belongs behind the bars and instruct the jailer to keep him there until he has served his time? I'm sorry to trouble you, sir, but one curse on this island is the lax enforcement of the law.
So, here's what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
Is that PEI didn't really seem to have any real problems.
No.
So they were like, who's sort of drunk around here?
And they were like, and this is, like, a really great example. So, this is to Premier Saunders, Premier from 1927 to 1930. And is it, like, a coincidence that all these guys were only premier for, like, 2 or 3 years where they were like, I'm out. I'm tired of all these letters from all the people in PEI.
Or maybe people were like, if we elect you, are you going to get rid of all the drinking? And they'd be like, yep, for sure, definitely. And then they'd be like, you didn't get rid of all the drinking. They'd be like, well, I tried my best. Bye.
So this letter to Premier Saunders. I understand that your government intended to appoint a prohibition inspector in the district of West Prince. And as I live here, I am and am fully acquainted with the smuggling, bootlegging, and stilling operations of this locality. I respectfully ask you to give me this appointment. So essentially they were
he
like...
He wanted to be Captain Prohibition?
Yeah. So he was like...
Of the prohibition
mission? I live here. I know everyone who's making illegal booze, like... put me on your, put me in coach, and I will, like.
He wanted to be the hall monitor.
Exactly.
He probably was never got to be the hall monitor in school.
No, I don't think he did. So officially, amongst all the shenanigans, Prohibition era officially ended on the island with the 1948 Temperance Act, which established government liquor stores. So that's how they eventually ended it, was they were like, now the government's selling it.
The LCBPEI.
I don't know what it's called in the PEI.
I think I'm sure probably, that's probably
Jake
what it's
could
called.
Tell us.
It's called the, that's, we nailed it.
Hey, Jake, tweet us. I don't think Jake will be listening at this point. However, bars never really took root in PEI, so there was never, I'm sure there are bars there now, but it was never, right when the Temperance Act came into effect in 1948, it wasn't like there was this great shift into public drinking houses. And to this day, Charlotte Town's famous illegal bootleggers are still serving the community. For example, in 2010, an 85-year-old man was found guilty of bootlegging and fined $10,000 after making no apologies to the court for selling booze. He said he's been selling liquor out of his house since he was 9 years old.
Oh my God.
And he's not hurting anyone. He's, quote, just trying to make an honest living.
This is why I could never be a judge, because I'd be like, great story, go ahead, you're free.
Like, he's 85 and he's been selling booze since he was 9, so, like, that's his whole life.
Yeah, it is.
Like, who's going to stop him? He's not going to even stop now. He's going to be like, here's $10,000, the house is open again. And there was this other story from, like, this year of this guy who passed away from cancer, but he had been this bootlegger for years and years and years, and the whole community knew him, and they all came to his funeral, like the mayor came to his funeral, because they all just, it was just like part of the life on PEI. So, bootlegging, alive and well in Prince Edward Island. Over to you, Emmers.
Thanks. So, I find these transitions very stressful.
Let me help you. Do-do-do-do-do-do. Emily's doing a story. Yes, she is. And Sally's sitting over there staring at me.
This is the opposite of helpful.
Okay.
So, thanks for that. I, today, am going to tell you about one man who is sometimes known as the king of bootleggers.
In the world?
In Canada.
Okay.
And his name was Rocco Perry.
That's a pretty good name.
Yay! This is like applause. Woo! So, yeah. Rocco Perry, born December 30th, 1887, in Plati, Calabria, in Italy. His family immigrated to the United States in 1903 and then to Canada in 1908. So he basically grew up in Canada with a little bit in Italy. In 1913...
Just like my mom.
Just like your mom. Hi, Mom. In 1913, 26-year-old Rocco Perry met a woman named Bessie Starkman.
Ooh.
And they started a love affair for the ages.
Ooh.
She immediately left her husband and two kids behind and was like, bye.
Betsy, no.
So from 1913 to 1916, Rocco worked a series of dead-end jobs. He first worked on building the Welland Canal, but then when the government shut that down because of the war, he got fired from that job.
Where is he, sorry, in Canada?
He's in Ontario. Like, all of this happened sort of in Ontario. He worked in a bakery, and he worked as a salesman for the Superior Macaroni Company.
Of course he did. He was like, I'm Italian. Have some macaroni.
It's the best of macaroni. I'm sorry about that. But September 16th, 1916... Bessie and Rocco caught a real break, because you know what happened? The Ontario Temperance Act!
Woo!
So they immediately, like, day one, were like, you know what we should do? Bootlegging.
Yeah. I do find it funny that it was there was no fear or concern. People were like, this will be a good way for me to make money.
Yeah. And Bessie had a lot of business smarts. Nice. And Rocco had a lot of connections in the sort of criminal world. So they immediately knew that they could be a success.
Who knew that macaroni sales was a direct link to the criminal world?
Right? Superior macaroni leads to being a criminal. I'm sorry if Superior Macaroni still exists. I'm sure your macaroni is great.
Yeah.
So a few developments in a row led to them being really successful. The first was that on December 23rd, 1917, Prohibition was officially declared in Canada.
Okay.
The second was that in April of 1918, it became illegal to transport alcohol in Canada. And in 1920, the 18th Amendment prohibited the sale of alcohol in the America.
In the America?
Yep. The only one. So it was sort of like all of these laws kept being put into effect that directly made their job easier because more people wanted illegal booze.
And it was harder and harder to get it.
Exactly. But Perry really saw himself as a real businessman. When I think of bootlegging, I think of like people like making moonshine in their bathtub.
Yeah, and then, like West Virginia.
Floating it across the river or whatever. But he was all about like being a real businessman. He specialized in exporting liquor from the big Canadian distilleries like Seagram and Goodrem and Worts to the U.S. And he helped these companies get a large share of the American market, which they kept after Prohibition ended. And it's one of the reasons that Canadian whiskey is so popular in the States still.
Oh.
Is because he was all about like the real business of it. And helping, even though what he was doing was illegal, he was like, no, you gotta do it right.
Yeah, well, and that was one of the things I read, was that there were so many, one of the big industries in Canada prior to the Temperance Act were these liquor manufacturers.
Yeah.
And they were, like, begging the government, like, please don't do this.
Exactly.
And so it was kind of like these bootleggers kind of kept a lot of them in business.
Totally. So. And which I also find hilarious because, like, you have a giant distillery that's obviously still working and they're just like, nope, nothing to see here. Continue
it's all
on
for,
your
it's
way.
All for the prescriptions.
It's the, ugh, that medicine. Everyone's so sick. So Perry has been linked to Frank Costello out of New York City and Al Capone out
Ooh.
Of Chicago as their Canadian whiskey distributor. But
Ooh.
it was never proven. And there's a lot of things about Rocco Perry that no one has ever proven that are just kind of rumors and stuff like that. And one time someone asked Al Capone whether he knew Rocco Perry. And he was quoted as saying, I don't even know which street Canada is on.
Oh, Al Capone.
Yeah.
You bastard.
Okay, well, that's a little harsh. I'm sure he was very nice.
No!
You're right, he wasn't. So Perry and Bessie Starkman built a huge business. They lived in a giant mansion in Hamilton, Ontario.
Ooh.
And they prided themselves on being legit. They were criminals who had principles. Perry's men weren't allowed to carry guns because he thought guns were totally despicable. And Rocco said that he was about quality, fair prices, and square dealing. That's a direct quote.
That's nice.
And we have so many quotes from him because in 1924, Rocco Perry and Bessie Starkman were interviewed by Toronto Daily Star reporter Dave Rogers. He gave them, Rocco Perry gave Dave Rogers this like exclusive interview. He invited him into his house and no one really knew anything about Rocco Perry. It was all just like myth and
so like people knew that he was a bootlegger.
100%.
Okay.
And he was so rich.
But like the police couldn't really do anything?
Because they didn't have any evidence.
Oh, okay.
So then he did this interview and in the interview he was like, oh yeah, I'm a bootlegger.
That's amazing.
I bootleg all the time. And then Bessie Starkman from the background was like, he's the king of bootleggers.
That's amazing.
Because they were so powerful by that point that nothing could be done.
Right.
And even when, like, police had this article in their hand that said, like, here's Rocco Perry saying, I am a bootlegger. They're like, well, we don't have any evidence, so there's no point trying to go after him. Because by this time they had been bootlegging for 8 years and they also had expanded into gambling, extortion, and prostitution.
Yikes.
So they were like the real Canadian crime
syndicate.
Good word. So it all kind of started to unravel in 1927 because Perry was compelled to testify at a tax evasion hearing against Goodrem and Worts. Because someone was like, okay, guys, you haven't paid your taxes, and we know you've been making illegal booze, so, like, something's gotta give.
Yeah, yeah. like how it's the taxes thing, though. Isn't that always, what got Al Capone?
Yeah, it's always the taxes. So in that testimony, Perry admitted to buying whiskey from Gooderham and Wirtz from 1924 to 1927. Okay. And this is one of the big reasons that they ended up getting convicted of tax evasion, and they had to pay a fine of $439,744.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's a very specific number.
Thank you. But also in 1927, Rocco Perry and Bessie Starkman both had to testify at a Royal Commission on Customs and Excise Inquiry.
Okay.
The Royal Commission on Customs and Excise Inquiry. Anyway, it was like this big hearing that was focusing on bootlegging and smuggling, because even though, as we learned from you, what's it called? Prohibition.
Yeah.
Prohibition.
That's what we've been talking about.
Prohibition was already sort of winding down.
Right.
But they still wanted to have this hearing and kind of get to the bottom of what was happening. And so then in that, Perry was like, I'm not a bootlegger. And they were like, remember this interview you did where you said you were a bootlegger? You said you were the king of bootleggers.
He's like, I was drunk. I mean, I was on medicine.
This whole time, he claimed that he was a salesman for the Superior Macaroni Company.
Yes.
But they were like, no.
He's like, I just make a lot of money. That's why I have this house.
That's why my macaroni is superior. But Perry and Bessie Starkman were both charged with perjury.
Oh, shit.
But Rocco Perry made a plea bargain so that Bessie would not go to jail.
Aww.
And he ended up serving 5 months of a 6 months. 5 months of a 6 month sentence.
Oh, that's like nothing at all.
Yeah. And I'm sure, like, he probably got, like, the cushy kind of jail.
Yeah.
So, he got out of jail in 1928, and they were like, great, we're back at it. Ready to go. So then they basically just continued to, like, rule everything until August 30th, 1930, when Bessie Starkman was shot and killed in their garage.
Whoa!
Yeah. And no one was ever even tried for the crime.
Do they not know?
Well, they think that it was a rival Italian crime family.
What?
Because throughout the 20s, there had been a series of murders.
Holy bananas.
That no one really knew, but people suspected Rocco Perry was behind them, but there was, like, really no evidence, and also the police didn't really care that much.
Right.
So, they think that it was this rival family that killed her.
Oh my god!
Yeah. And Perry was, I don't know, probably sad.
I'm sure he was!
It's hard to say. He didn't do any more interviews.
Well, he did that, like, make that deal to get his wife out of prison time, so I'm sure he was
sad. Actually, the other thing about it was that they were never married. They were only common law. But everyone was like, I don't know, you have so much money, I guess it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So, he continued on, sort of, with, like, low-level dealings, but things began to get more and more dangerous for him. There were more and more attempts on his life. In 1938, part of his house exploded when dynamite was placed under his veranda.
Oh, my gosh.
And also, his car exploded from a car bomb.
Has there not been a Rocco Perry movie?
But he was not injured in either attempt.
Oh, my god.
So, like, they were really bad at it.
Bad saboteurs.
Then, honestly, his life is crazy. 1940 to 1943, he's sent to an internment camp at Camp Petawawa as part of the Italian-Canadian internment, because him and his brother Michael were seen as potentially dangerous enemy aliens who had ties to Mussolini because they were born in Italy and because they were criminals.
Oh my god, I had no idea there were Italian internment camps.
Yeah, Camp Petawawa. So he was released in 1943.
That's it. I just need a moment.
Okay.
That's crazy.
I'm not done my story, which,
like,
is really derailing.
I knew
right
that
now,
there were internment camps, of course, because Canada can go fuck itself at certain points in history. But for some reason, I don't know, like, I know that my mom faced a lot of, like, racism and kind of gross stuff when she immigrated, but she immigrated post-war.
Mm-hmm.
I did not know that. Okay, you can continue. I'm just taking it in It's horrifying.
Well, and we can talk about it more in a further episode.
Okay.
A future episode.
I don't know.
Future episode.
Okay, go ahead.
So, April 23rd, 1944, Rocco Perry goes for a walk to clear his head. He's never seen again.
Whoa!
What a twist ending!
Wait, what year was that?
1944.
So he got out of the internment camp.
In 1943.
And then, like, a year later, he just goes for a walk.
And he was like, guys, he told people, he was like, I'm going for a walk, I gotta clear my head. And then they never saw him again.
Oh,
so there's kind of two camps. There's one camp that believes that...
He got murderated.
He got murderated, and that he got... He got cement shoes and was thrown in Hamilton Harbor.
Ooh.
But the other camp thinks that he just, that was like his plan, and he fled to the U.S. because there was like too much heat from rival crime families.
Oh.
And in the 90s, this, I guess he's like a mafia expert, he uncovered this letter written by Perry to a cousin of his in Italy, and it was dated 1949.
Ooh!
And it said in Italian, like, I am alive and well. And that cousin said that Perry died in the States in 1953.
Holy shit.
But honestly, no one knows.
That's crazy.
And he was the king of the bootleggers.
There's, like, a lot happened in that story. It was a real whirlwind.
Yep. And I don't have a lot of details. But can I tell you my favorite thing about Rocco Perry?
Yes, please.
He was 5'4".
He's just a little baby.
Just a tiny baby.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and I imagine
I could have put him in my pocket.
I imagine that he always wore really nice suits.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
And he probably had a lot of hats.
Yep, yep,
and
yep.
He probably liked to get his shoes shined.
Yeah, 100%. And, like, maybe he, like, smoked a nice cigar.
Probably.
Yeah.
So that's the story of Rocco Perry.
I feel like that's a lot. I feel like a lot just happened. I'm still a bit reeling over the internment camps.
I know you are. You got some reading to do.
I know. Maybe I shouldn't have said that Italian people faced racism. Does that count as racism? I don't know. Prejudice, I guess.
Honestly, racism is complicated.
It is complicated.
And systemic.
Well.
And I hope Get Out wins all the Oscars.
Me too. Well, here's to another great episode. Right. I'm going to drink my medicine.
Right, I can't cheers you. Dry January.
Well, Emily, I guess I'll just cheers myself and drink this all by myself because it's a great time for a glass of wine.
We might need the Temperance Union up in her.